Station number 11766, Mr. T.H. Harville, Reel 3.
Mr. Harville, Reel 3.
Yeah, so there were special escape boots whereby you had a little knife in the boot and you could undo the stitching and cut the stitching of the leggings, and it left you with a pair of shoes. Outwardly, it was only a pair of shoes, but they were lined, lamb's wool lined, you know. But we passed by him. So he kind of made a name for himself because they were searching for me still. And there I was, right under his nose. Went into the graveyard, in the cemetery rather, and went to the grave, and it was piled high with flowers. You know, people must have come from miles around to pile flowers on top of that grave.
Of the RAF air crew?
Yeah, five lads, you know. And we stood there amongst the other people that were standing there paying their homage, you know, for a while. And then we went back then for the bikes, went into the town to a confectioner's shop. We went in there through, it was a Mr. Didinol and his wife that ran the shop, went to his parlour, and then there's still nobody to speak English until Joe Furbus arrived, and he was American. He'd settled there, married in the First World War, and remained there. And he was around the local garage. He came in with his wife, and it was nice to be able to converse in English. And he told me that, you know, all about five members of the crew, you know, they were mostly carbonized, you know, but the dog tags had identified him, and he was one of the local gendarmes, Monsieur Camille, was coming in, and he could verify, you know, probably who they were. And it was shortly after that Camille came in with his gendarme uniform on. And he told Furbus, because he couldn't speak English, he told Furbus that there was one prisoner. The prisoner was named Robinson. Of course, that was my navigator. I knew then who the other survivor was. Mm-hmm. I stayed the night there, and then next morning there was one of these old charcoal-driven muddy cars with a bag on top, you know. Called at the shop, and I don't really know who these two blokes were, the driver and his friend. Anyhow, I was put into the car, and we drove at speed, as if you call it speed, well, it was charcoal driven, down to Haut-Marne.
Where?
It was a place called Sous-le-Corps in Haut-Marne. It was next to Lorraine, you know. It's about, I suppose it was about 20 kilometres, or probably a bit more. Anyhow, there was an old ancient mill on the river there, at Sous-le-Corps. And this was the home of Madame Dubois and her daughter Mimi. And they were active resistance, so was Mimi's prospective husband, Hautier, and he was the chief of the resistance in the area. So I stayed in the mill for a few days with Madame Dubois, and there was one scare one night when the Germans were about, and But apart from that, it was made a nice rest there, you know. And I think it was on the third day that, of course, she could speak English, or quite a fair English, Madame Dubois. And she told me that her aunt, who lived in the village, was hiding an airman, a Canadian, French Canadian. She, Madame Ridges, was her aunt. She said he was going to bring the Canadian airman to the mill, and then we were going on to a place called Bandy Bend. Anyhow, this turned out to be a French Canadian rear gunner. He was a sole survivor of a Stirling that some few nights before, well, it was before I was shot down actually, they were looking for a dropping zone to drop supplies to the Mackay near Chaumont. And they'd come down too low. There were some hills near Sulacor, quite high hills, and they crashed, and he was the only survivor. His turret had broken away and rolled down into the bushes. The crew of the Stirling and some army officers that were going to be dropped by parachute all perished in the crash. Yeah, that was... His name was Paul Bell, this French-Canadian. He was a rear... I'd say he'd been a rear gunner on this Stirling. Of course, being French-Canadian, he spoke fluent French. That was a bonus for me, because I had no more problems about translation. We went to Bendy Bend, and we stayed for a couple of nights in the home, and the schoolmaster of the school there, Mr. Perno, and then we moved to the home of the local transport boss. He had a transport firm. Let me say that there were only crude sort of lorries in those days, obviously, but he used to take pit props into Switzerland for the mines. So he made a frame, a space, you know, a steel cage in one of his, putting his lorries, put pit props on top, and he was going to run us into Switzerland under these pit props. But we'd go near the border, frontier. There was a Mackay, a place called Chateau Lambert, and you know, he'd take us in the cab, and then we'd transfer to this little cage under his pit props, and they'd build the pit props around us, and we'd go over the border. His name was Beaurepaire, Martial Beaurepaire, this transport bloke. And while we were there, I was, the day before we were to go, I had a button come off trousers, you know, I had bracers, you know, and his wife was sewing a button on, and then suddenly a vehicle pulled up outside. The path from the house went up a slope, and the road was on a higher level than the house. And it was a German vehicle, and two German officers got out and started walking down the path. And I stood at me. She was trousers undone because she was sewing on the button. Anyhow, we jumped out of the, scrambled out of the window of the room into the back garden, went down the bottom of the garden and hid. And anyhow, wasn't too much to worry about, because these were two German officers that were checking on inventory of transport that might be available if they wanted to commandeer it. And they'd come to see Beaurepaire, you know, see what vehicles he had. Well, it was a bit of a fright at the time. So the next day, we got him into his lorry, and then he called a hotel. He also owned a hotel in Bendy Bend, and he kept the revolver there. And he parked the lorry outside while he went and got his revolver. And then two SS officers came out of the German headquarters there and stood on the pavement right by the cab talking, and I was nearest the pavement. If they'd have spoken in French, and Paul Bell would have been all right to reply. I don't suppose he would have spotted his accent, but it was a bit hair raising for a moment. Bow Repair came out and off we went. And we got the Chateau Lambert, I saw the chief of the resistance, and he said, in no circumstances should we try to go over the border. He said the Vichy police were patrolling the border now, he said. And this is what Paul Bell told me. And he said that they were worse than the Germans if they got hold of it. He said you thought you'd get shot out of hand, you know. He said it was too risky. So, we stayed in the camp. We moved up to a camp in the hill there. And the plan was for us the next day to go to Montbéliard, which was on foot. It was cross country. It's quite a trek.
Why was that? Why was the idea to go to Montbéliard?
Well, he said that if you go to Montbéliard, in that area, it's easier to cross into Switzerland. So, where we were, it's, he said it's not so heavily policed in that. And he said he knew the resistance down there. They used to trek over into Switzerland to the British consulate there, you know. So we had a guide, and he took us quite a hot, strenuous march it was across sort of very heady country. And when we got on the out near Montbéliard, we came out of a wood at a place called Dung, D-U-N-G. And we come out into a hay field, believe it, making hay. There was nobody there, but we walked over towards a gate, and there was a German soldier standing there, leaning on the gate. Armed German soldier, and he'd been on patrol, I suppose. I'm a break, you know. So we got halfway across before we spotted him. And anyhow, the guide stopped us, and he went over and picked up two pitchforks and gave us one each. And we walked to the gate with the pitchforks over our shoulders. And the guide, he passed the time of day with the German. And we went on. And he took us into the wood, into a wood, a small wood at Dun. And he said, you stay here tonight, and keep down and amongst the bushes, you know. And he would send somebody the next day. Anyhow, the next day, the Jean Hoge turned up. He was the friend, you know, the one that worked with Harry Ray. He was the chief of the resistance chief, but also a member of the Bakunist organization. And he told Paul, he told us, you know, because he spoke English. Being a schoolmaster, he was pretty well aggressed with the language. He said he went into Switzerland from time to time when he knew to find out where the routes, safe routes over, because he used to go to the British consulate with information. But by that time, we decided, he said, brought us up to date on the news, and he said that we could listen to the BBC when we get down to his house in Montbéliard. So he took us to his house, and we used to listen to the broadcast there. And it turned out that we learned the United States 7th Army and the French 1st Army had landed at the Marseille, and were coming up from the south. So we knew that we'd had a better chance going towards the that army than waiting for the army coming from Normandy. So we said that we didn't want to go into Switzerland, we wanted to join the resistance. And so he said, well, that's all right. He said, but he said, my headquarters is a place called Londres. He said, it's this was about 20 miles south, you know, about 30. So he'd arranged for us to go down there, and he was going there himself. And while we were there, we didn't actually stay in his house. We slept in the goat pen house at the back of the back garden where he kept the goats. And we only just came in for the house for our meals and listened to the BBC. So there was a young lad, 14 years old. He had a withered arm, Gilo, and he was to be our guide. And resistance has stolen two bicycles from the Peugeot factory for us. And that was the one that Harry Ray had sabotaged. You know. So off we went the next day. Gilo and myself and Paul Bell. We stopped halfway at a place called, a village called Sancy-le-Grand, and had a farmhouse there, and we slept in the barn. I always remember there was a picture of Joe Stalin there. He was a communist, this farmer, and he had this big picture of Joe Stalin up on the wall. From there, we went on the next day down to Londres, to Rennie's Cafe. And it's odd that a TV series should be based on Rennie's Cafe.
You're talking about Allo, Allo?
Yeah, and oddly enough, it was exactly the same, you know. And the characters and whatnot, you know. This was John O'Donnell's headquarters, and he was there with two or three others. And there's Rennie and his wife Marth. They were mostly in it for the money, you know. They used to pay them for money. John O'J used to pay them for money that was dropped by parachute. And anyhow, he was quite happy to put us up, and but he wouldn't have me in the cafe. I had to go in the stable because I didn't speak French, and he was worried that I would start speaking to Paul Bell in English. As German officers used to call in there when they were out getting supplies, you know, for their mess and that. So anyway, we got issued with armbands there. John O'J issued armbands. And Dee Dee, she was a double agent. She was a girlfriend of a German commandant in Montbéliard. But she also worked for the in the office of the prefecture of police, and she got us identity cards. And
how do you mean she was a double agent?
Well, she wasn't giving information to the Germans in as much, you know, of the resistance. But it was the other way about. Any information she got, she was given to Jean Auger, and he was passing it on to the British consulate in Switzerland. But she had an unfortunate after the war, if I might jump a bit, Dee Dee, because of her relationship with this German officer, she got 5 years in jail. And Jean Auger, as far as I know, he never came forward and said she was working for the resistance. And I know, of course, I never knew, because I never went to that part for some years after, although I went back to Neufchâteau and places immediately after the war in that area, Benny-Ben and Sulacourt. Unless I would have made some representation then, you know, if I'd have found she'd have been put in jail.
So you felt she had You felt she had been unjustly dealt with.
Oh yes, yeah. Because John Auger was a married man, and he was having an affair with Dee Dee. So you can quite see why he never came forward. And we say she'd taken a great risk by getting us these identity cards, because if we'd had been pulled into the checkpoint and or been captured, and they found these on us and they traced them back. They might have traced them back to her, you know. And while we were there, Jean Lavelle was working. He was a young chap. Well, he was about 18, 19. He'd been a student at Nancy University. And he were working for Jean Auger. And he'd been captured. And he'd gone to the... They put him in the SS... prison at Besançon, in the old citadel there. That's where they had the execution post and that. They're still there to this day. And Jean Lavelle, he hadn't, you know, they'd tortured him and that, but he hadn't spilled any beans about the setup there at Londres. So anyway, they decided to deport him, and they put him in a railway truck at Besançon Sidings with others. And gendarme there took pity on him, and when the Germans weren't looking, he let him jump out and get away. And we were sunning ourselves in the orchard there in Rennie's, back in Rennie's cafe, when John Lavelle came out of the woods. You know, he'd made his way back. It's quite a story in itself. He still suffers this day for because of his treatment. He died, you know, he's in poor health. Well, it was then decided that we should join the resistance group at Belmont Farm, which is on a hill near Pierrefontaine. And there were seven of us all together, myself, Paul Bell, and we had these, each had an armband with the FFI. Red, white, and blue armband, FFI, on the Cross of Lorraine. I thought it was odd that I was wearing the Cross of Lorraine, because I'd been shot down at Domremy, the birthplace of Joan of Arc, whose symbol it was. Anyhow, we set out one more late in the morning, trekking to this stronghold up on the hill, you know, this resistance stronghold. Where this group, this is there's the hill there.
You're showing me a book now called De Loge au Éloge, Un Chemin Difficile, about the resistance Centre Doubs.
Yeah. And that was a group we were going to join. We, anyway, it was a beautiful afternoon, a beautiful day, and as we came into Pierrefontaine, the village at the foot of that hill, well, it's a large village, it's probably a small town now, we came onto the main street, and we were singing the Marseillaise. We had there was a tricolour on a stick, and we all had the armbands, obviously I didn't know the words of it. Marseillaise, but I could hum it, and we had a real shock as we walked on the main street. There was a bistro just down on the left, and there was a horse-drawn cart outside, and there was three Germans, well, and soldiers in uniform, one arm too, and they were drinking, and we stopped dead. The singing stopped. And we all grabbed for our guns, you know. This was like a high noon shootout, you know. And suddenly a window opened of a house. We were standing outside. And the woman shouted, "La Russe, La Russe." I can always remember that. And Paul Bell said, she said, "They're Russians." Anyhow. One of the resistance blokes, taught Paul Bell, because they never made any move to shoot us, you know. And he said, they're Cossacks, he says, Ukrainians. He said, from the barracks, the German camp at Verdehon. He said, they, you know, they were, obviously they were wearing the German uniform. He said, but they've deserted. He said, a lot of them deserted. He said, the whole battalion's deserted. And when we got up into the camp on the hill, where all the group were, just sit to one side on the edge of the wood, there was all these Ukrainians in German uniform with their horses, well armed, in a camp there. They defected and joined this group. It seemed weird, really. It was like a film set, you know, all the blokes, all the Mackie with their guns and the armbands, and all these soldiers in German uniform and the horses.
So they joined the Mackie group?
Yeah, there was 400. There was the 2nd Ukrainian Battalion. They'd only been at Verdehon a few days. They'd been brought all over from Germany, you know, troops shipped, brought in from Germany. And
what impression did you get of them?
Well, we were, I was a bit apprehensive about them. So was everybody else at night, because let me say that they were turncoats. They changed sides twice already, the Russian, the German, German and the Mackie. And right, it could have been a ruse. They could have wiped us out. They were so well armed, you know, they had all German machine pistols and whatnot. And while we were all sleeping at night, we would have been, a lot of us could have been wiped out. But as it turned out, they turned out to be marvelous friends. They liberated the region. They retook the town, the Verdehon, the camp. While I was there, there was we had several prisoners there. There was two women who had their heads shaved. They were jerry bags, you know. And there was a man in his 20s who'd been informant on the Mackie and been captured. He'd been informant to the Germans. And I think that I understood that a couple of the Mackie had been picked up because of him. You know. I decided to shoot him as a firing squad, you know. And that afternoon, it was raining, and we all formed a circle, and I helped clean the guns. They wanted me to take part in the firing squad. I said, to Paul Bell, I said, you know, well, both of us, you know. And they said, invited us. I said, well, I don't know what he's done. And I said, best keep out. I did help to clean the guns, prepare them. And yeah, the circle was formed, and all except for the back part, of course. And the firing squad assembled, and he was brought out. And he walked out quite boldly, you know. He didn't seem to have any fear at all. He stood in front of the firing squad, and the chef, the chief, he handed him a blindfold, which he wouldn't take. And so yeah, just before the guns fired, he shouted out, "Vive la France!" And I think he must have been, I don't think he was French, because he said something, "Vive la," something else, you know.
Some other country?
I think so. And I,